Chapter 3. Giscard. 9. Bailey turned and said to Daniil,
"It annoys me, Daniil, that I must remain a prisoner here because the Aurorans on board this ship fear me as a source of infection. This is pure superstition. I have been treated."
Daniil said, "It is not because of Auroran fears that you are being asked to remain in your cabin, partner Elijah."
"No? What other reason?"
"Perhaps you remember that, when we first met on this ship, you asked me my reasons for being sent to escort you. I said it was to give you something familiar as an anchor, and to please me. I was then about to tell you the third reason, when Giscard interrupted us with your viewer and viewing material, and thereafter we launched into a discussion of roboticide."
"And you never told me the third reason. What is it?"
"Why, partner Elijah, it is merely that I might help protect you."
"Against what?"
"Unusual passions have been stirred by the incident we have agreed to call roboticide. You are being called to Aurora to help demonstrate Dr. Fastolf's innocence. And the hyperwave drama..."
"Jehoshaphat, Daniil," said Bailey in outrage. "Have they seen that thing on Aurora, too?"
"They have seen it throughout the spacer worlds, partner Elijah. It was a most popular program, and has made it quite plain that you are a most extraordinary investigator."
"So that whoever might be behind the roboticide may well have exaggerated fears of what I might accomplish, and might therefore risk a great deal to prevent my arrival, or to kill me."
"Dr. Fastolf," said Daniil calmly, "is quite convinced that no one is behind the roboticide, since no human being other than himself could have carried it through. It was a purely fortuitous occurrence, in Dr. Fastolf's view. However, there are those who are trying to capitalize on the occurrence, and it would be to their interest to keep you from proving that. For that reason, you must be protected."
Bailey took a few hasty steps to one wall of the room and then back to the other, as though to speed his thought processes by physical example. Somehow he did not feel any sense of personal danger. He said, "Daniil, how many humaniform robots are there altogether on Aurora?"
"Do you mean now that Jander no longer functions?"
"Yes, now that Jander is dead."
"One, partner Elijah."
Bailey stared at Daniil in shock. Soundlessly, he mouthed the word, "One?" Finally, he said, "Let me understand this, Daniil. You are the only humaniform robot on Aurora?"
"Or on any world, partner Elijah. I thought you were aware of this. I was the prototype, and then Jander was constructed. Since then, Dr. Fastolf has refused to construct any more, and no one else has the skill to do it."
"But in that case, since of two humaniform robots, one has been killed, does it not occur to Dr. Fastolf that the remaining humaniform, you, Daniil, might be in danger?"
"He recognizes the possibility. But the chance that the fantastically unlikely occurrence of mental freeze-out would take place a second time is remote. He doesn't take it seriously. He feels, however, that there might be a chance of other misadventure. That, I think, played some small part in his sending me to Earth to get you. It kept me away from Aurora for a week or so."
"And you are now as much a prisoner as I am, aren't you, Daniil?"
"I am a prisoner," said Daniil gravely, "only in the sense, partner Elijah, that I am expected not to leave this room."
"In what other sense is one a prisoner?"
"In the sense that the person so restricted in his movements resents the restriction. A true imprisonment has the implication of being involuntary. I quite understand the reason for being here, and I concur in the necessity."
"You do," grumbled Bailey. "I do not. I am a prisoner in the full sense. And what keeps us safe here, anyway?"
"For one thing, partner Elijah, Giscard is on duty outside."
"Is he intelligent enough for the job?"
"He understands his orders entirely. He is rugged and strong, and quite realizes the importance of his task."
"You mean he is prepared to be destroyed to protect the two of us?"
"Yes, of course. Just as I am prepared to be destroyed to protect you."
Bailey felt abashed. He said, "You do not resent the situation in which you may be forced to give up your existence for me?"
It is my programming, partner Elijah,
said Daniil, in a voice that seemed to soften.
Yet somehow it seems to me that, even were it not for my programming, saving you makes the loss of my own existence seem quite trivial in comparison.
Bailey could not resist this. He held out his hand and closed it on Daniil's with a fierce grip.
Thank you, partner Daniil, but please do not allow it to happen. I do not wish the loss of your existence. The preservation of my own would be inadequate compensation, it seems to me.
And Bailey was amazed to discover that he really meant it. He was faintly horrified to realize that he would be ready to risk his life for a robot.
No, not for a robot. For Daniil.
10. Giscard entered without signaling. Bailey had come to accept that. The robot, as his guard, had to be able to come and go as he pleased. And Giscard was only a robot in Bailey's eyes, however much he might be a he, and however much one did not mention the R. If Bailey were scratching himself, picking his nose, engaged in any messy biological function, it seemed to him that Giscard would be indifferent, non-judgmental, incapable of reacting in any way, but coldly recording the observation in some inner memory bank. It made Giscard simply a piece of mobile furniture, and Bailey felt no embarrassment in his presence. Not that Giscard had ever intruded on him at an inconvenient moment, Bailey thought idly. Giscard brought a small cubicle with him.
Sir, I suspect you still wish to observe Aurora from space.
Bailey started. No doubt. Daniil had noted Bailey's irritation and had deduced its cause and taken this way of dealing with it. To have Giscard do it and present it as an idea of his simple-minded own was a touch of delicacy on Daniil's part. It would free Bailey of the necessity of expressing gratitude, or so Daniil would think. Bailey had, as a matter of fact, been more irritated at being, to his way of thinking, needlessly kept from the view of Aurora than at being kept imprisoned generally. He had been fretting over the loss of the view during the 2 days since the jump. So he turned and said to Daniil,
"Thank you, my friend."
"It was Giscard's idea," said Daniil.
"Yes, of course," said Bailey with a small smile.
"I thank him, too. What is this, Giscard?"
"It is an astro-simulator, sir. It works essentially like a tri-dimensional receiver and is connected to the view room. If I might add..."
"Yes?"
"You will not find the view particularly exciting, sir. I would not wish you to be unnecessarily disappointed."
"I will try not to expect too much, Giscard. In any case, I will not hold you responsible for any disappointment I might feel."
"Thank you, sir. I must return to my post, but Daniil will be able to help you with the instrument if any problem arises."
He left, and Bailey turned to Daniil with approval.
"Giscard handled that very well, I thought. He may be a simple model, but he's well designed."
"He, too, is a Fastolf robot, partner Elijah. This astro-simulator is self-contained and self-adjusted. Since it is already focused on Aurora, it is only necessary to touch the control edge. That will put it in operation, and you need do nothing more. Would you care to set it going yourself?"
Bailey shrugged.
"No need. You may do it."
"Very well."
Daniil had placed the cubicle upon the table on which Bailey had done his book film viewing.
"This," he said, indicating a small rectangle in his hand, "is the control, partner Elijah. You need only hold it by the edges in this manner, and then exert a small inward pressure to turn the mechanism on, and then another to turn it off."
Daniil pressed the control edge, and Bailey shouted in a strangled way. Bailey had expected the cubicle to light up and to display within itself a holographic representation of a starfield. That was not what happened. Instead, Bailey found himself in space, in space, with bright, unblinking stars in all directions. It lasted for only a moment, and then everything was back as it was, the room and, within it, Bailey, Daniil, and the cubicle.
"My regrets, partner Elijah," said Daniil.
I turned it off as soon as I understood your discomfort. I did not realize you were not prepared for the event.
Then prepare me. What happened?
The astro simulator works directly on the visual center of the human brain. There is no way of distinguishing the impression it leaves from three-dimensional reality. It is a comparatively recent device, and so far it has been used only for astronomical scenes which are, after all, low in detail.
Did you see it too, Daniil?
Yes, but very poorly and without the realism a human being experiences. I see the dim outline of a scene superimposed upon the still clear contents of the room, but it has been explained to me that human beings see the scene only. Undoubtedly, when the brains of those such as myself are still more finely tuned and adjusted...
Bailey had recovered his equilibrium.
Well, the point is, Daniil, that I was aware of nothing else. I was not aware of myself. I did not see my hands or sense where they were. I felt as though I were a disembodied spirit, or as I imagine I would feel if I were dead but were consciously existing in some sort of immaterial afterlife.
I see now why you would find that rather disturbing.
Actually, I found it very disturbing.
My regrets, Partner Elijah. I shall have Giscard take this away.
No, I'm prepared now. Let me have that cube. Will I be able to turn it off, even though I am not conscious of the existence of my hands?
It will cling to your hand, so that you will not drop it, Partner Elijah. I have been told by Dr. Fastolf, who has experienced this phenomenon, that the pressure is automatically applied when the human being holding it wills an end. It is an automatic phenomenon based on nerve manipulation, as the vision itself is. At least, that is how it works with Aurorans, and I imagine...
That Earthmen are sufficiently similar to Aurorans physiologically for it to work with us as well. Very well. Give me the control and I will try.
With a slight internal wince, Bailey squeezed the control edge and was in space again. He was expecting it this time, and once he found he could breathe without difficulty and did not feel in any way as though he were immersed in a vacuum, he labored to accept it all as a visual illusion. Breathing rather stertorously, perhaps to convince himself he was actually breathing, he stared about curiously in all directions. Suddenly aware he was hearing his breath rasp in his nose, he said,
"Can you hear me, Daniil?"
He heard his own voice, a little distant, a little artificial, but he heard it. And then he heard Daniil's, different enough to be distinguishable.
"Yes, I can," said Daniil. "And you should be able to hear me, Partner Elijah. The visual and kinesthetic senses are interfered with for the sake of a greater illusion of reality, but the auditory sense remains untouched. Largely so, at any rate."
"Well, I see only stars, ordinary stars, that is. Aurora has a sun. We are close enough to Aurora, I imagine, to make the star that is its sun considerably brighter than the others."
"Entirely too bright, Partner Elijah. It is blanked out, or you might suffer retinal damage."
"Then where is the planet Aurora?"
"Do you see the constellation of Orion?"
"Yes, I do. Do you mean we still see the constellations as we see them in Earth's sky, as in the city planetarium?"
"Just about. As stellar distances go, we are not far from Earth and the solar system of which it is part, so that they have the star view in common. Aurora's sun is known as Tau Ceti on Earth, and is only 3.67 parsecs from there. Now, if you'll imagine a line from Betelgeuse to the middle star of Orion's belt, and continue it for an equal length and a bit more, the middling bright star you see is actually the planet Aurora. It will become increasingly unmistakable over the next few days, as we approach it rapidly."
Bailey regarded it gravely. It was just a bright, star-like object. There was no luminous arrow going on and off, pointing to it. There was no carefully lettered inscription arced over it. He said, "Where's the sun? Earth's star, I mean."
"It's in the constellation Virgo, as seen from Aurora. It is a second magnitude star. Unfortunately, the astro simulator we have is not properly computerized, and it would not be easy to point it out to you. It would, in any case, just appear to be a star, quite an ordinary one.
Never mind, said Bailey. I'm going to turn off this thing now. If I have trouble, help out.
He didn't have trouble. It flicked off just as he thought of doing so, and he sat blinking in the suddenly harsh light of the room. It was only then, when he had returned to his normal senses, that it occurred to him that for some minutes he had seemed to himself to have been out in space, without a protecting wall of any kind, and yet his earthly agoraphobia had not been activated. He had been perfectly comfortable once he had accepted his own non-existence. The thought puzzled him and distracted him from his book film viewing for a while. Periodically, he returned to the astrosimulator and took another look at space as seen from a vantage point just outside the spaceship, with himself nowhere present, apparently. Sometimes it was just for a moment to reassure himself that he was still not made uneasy by the infinite void. Sometimes he found himself lost in the pattern of the stars, and he began lazily counting them or forming geometrical figures, rather luxuriating in the ability to do something which, on Earth, he would never have been able to do because the mounting agoraphobic uneasiness would quickly have overwhelmed everything else. Eventually, it grew quite obvious that Aurora was brightening. It soon became easy to detect among the other dots of light, then unmistakable, and finally, unavoidable. It began as a tiny sliver of light, and thereafter, it enlarged rapidly and began to show phases. It was almost precisely a half circle of light when Bailey became aware of the existence of phases. Bailey inquired, and Daniil said, "We are approaching from outside the orbital plane, Partner Elijah. Aurora's south pole is more or less in the center of its disk, somewhat into the lighted half. It is spring in the southern hemisphere."
Bailey said, "Well, according to the material I have been reading, Aurora's axis is tipped 16 degrees.
He had glanced over the physical description of the planet with insufficient attention in his anxiety to get to the Aurorans, but he remembered that.
"Yes, Partner Elijah. Eventually we will move into orbit about Aurora, and the phases will then change rapidly. Aurora revolves more rapidly than Earth does."
"It has a 22-hour day, yes."
"A day of 22.3 traditional hours. The Auroran day is divided into 10 Auroran hours, with each hour divided into 100 Auroran minutes, which are in turn divided into 100 Auroran seconds. An Auroran second is thus roughly equal to 0.8 Earth seconds."
"Is that what the books mean when they refer to metric hours, metric minutes, and so on?"
"Yes. It was difficult to persuade the Aurorans at first to abandon the time units to which they were accustomed, and both systems, the standard and the metric, were in use. Eventually, of course, the metric won out. At present, we speak only of hours, minutes, and seconds, but the decimalized versions are invariably meant. The same system has been adopted throughout the spacer worlds, even though on the other worlds it does not tie in with the natural rotation of the planet. Each planet also uses a local system, of course."
"As Earth does."
"Yes, Partner Elijah. But Earth uses only the original standard time units. That inconveniences the spacer worlds where trade is concerned, but they allow Earth to go its way in this."
"Not out of friendliness, I imagine. I suspect they wish to emphasize Earth's difference. How does decimalization fit in with the year? After all, Aurora must have a natural period of revolution about its sun that controls the cycle of its seasons. How is that measured?"
Daniil said,
"Aurora revolves about its sun in 373.5 Auroran days, or in about 0.95 Earth years. That is not considered a vital matter in chronology. Aurora accepts 30 of its days as equaling a month, and 10 months as equaling a metric year. The metric year is equal to about 0.8 seasonal years, or about 3/4 of an Earth year. The relationship is different on each world, of course. 10 days is usually referred to as a decimonth. All the spacer worlds use this system."
"Well, surely there must be some convenient way of following the cycle of the seasons."
each world has its seasonal year too, but it is little regarded. One can, by computer, convert any day, past or present, into its position in the seasonal year if, for any reason, such information is desired. And this is true on any world where conversion to and from the local days is also as easily possible. And of course, Partner Elijah, any robot can do the same and can guide human activity where the seasonal year or local time is relevant. The advantage of metricized units is that it supplies humanity with a unified chronometry that involves little more than decimal point shifts.
It bothered Bailey that the books he viewed made none of this clear. But then, from his own knowledge of Earth's history, he knew that at one time the lunar month had been the key to the calendar, and that there had come a time when, for ease of chronometry, the lunar month came to be ignored and was never missed. Yet if he had given books on Earth to some stranger, that stranger would have likely found no mention of the lunar month or any historical change in calendars. Dates would have been given without explanation. What else would be given without explanation? How far could he rely, then, on the knowledge he was gaining? He would have to ask questions constantly, take nothing for granted. There would be so many opportunities to miss the obvious, so many chances to misunderstand, so many ways of taking the wrong path.
11. Aurora filled his vision now when he used the astrosimulator, and it looked like Earth. Bailey had never seen Earth in the same way, but there had been photographs in astronomy texts, and he had seen those. Well, what Bailey saw on Aurora were the same cloud patterns, the same glimpse of desert areas, the same large stretches of day and night, the same pattern of twinkling light in the expanse of the night hemisphere as the photographs showed on Earth's globe. Bailey watched raptly and thought, what if, for some reason, he had been taken into space, told he was being brought to Aurora, and was, in reality, being returned to Earth for some reason, for some subtle and insane reason? How could he tell the difference before landing? Was there reason to be suspicious? Daniil had carefully told him that the constellations were the same in the sky of both planets, but wouldn't that be naturally so for planets circling neighboring stars? The gross appearance of both planets from space was identical, but wouldn't that be expected if both were habitable and comfortably suited to human life? Was there any reason to suppose such a far-fetched deception would be played upon him? What purpose would it serve? And yet, why shouldn't it be made to appear far-fetched and useless? If there were an obvious reason to do such a thing, he would have seen through it at once. Would Daniil be party to such a conspiracy? Surely not, if he were a human being, but he was only a robot. Might there not be a way to order him to behave appropriately? There was no way of coming to a decision. Bailey found himself watching for glimpses of continental outlines that he could recognize as earthly or as non-earthly. That would be the telling test. Except that it didn't work. The glimpses that came and went hazily through the clouds were of no use to him. He was not sufficiently knowledgeable about Earth's geography. What he really knew of Earth were its underground cities, its caves of steel. The bits of coastline he saw were unfamiliar to him. Whether Aurora or Earth, he did not know. Why this uncertainty anyway? When he had gone to Solaria, he had never doubted his destination. He had never suspected that they might be bringing him back to Earth. Ah, but then he had gone on a clear-cut mission in which there was reasonable chance for success. Now, he felt, there was no chance at all. Perhaps it was, then, that he wanted to be returned to Earth and was building a false conspiracy in his mind so that he could imagine it possible. The uncertainty in his mind had come to have a life of its own. He couldn't let go. He found himself watching Aurora with an almost mad intensity, unable to come back to the cabin reality. Aurora was moving, turning slowly. He had watched long enough to see that. While he had been viewing space, everything had seemed motionless, like a painted backdrop, a silent and static pattern of dots of light, with, later on, a small half-circle included. Was it the motionlessness that had enabled him to be non-agoraphobic? But now he could see Aurora moving, and he realized that the ship was spiraling down in the final stage before landing. The clouds were bellying upward. No, not the clouds. The ship was spiraling downward. The ship was moving. He was moving. He was suddenly aware of his own existence. He was hurtling downward through the clouds. He was falling, unguarded, through thin air towards solid ground. His throat constricted. It was becoming very hard to breathe. He told himself desperately, "You are enclosed. The walls of the ship are around you." But he sensed no walls. He thought, "Even without considering the walls, you are still enclosed. You are wrapped in skin." But he sensed no skin. The sensation was worse than simple nakedness. He was an unaccompanied personality, the essence of identity totally uncovered, a living point, a singularity surrounded by an open and infinite world. And he was falling. He wanted to close off the vision, contract his fist upon the control edge, but nothing happened. His nerve endings had so abnormalized that the automatic contraction at an effort of will did not work. He had no will. Eyes would not close, fist would not contract. He was caught and hypnotized by terror, frightened into immobility. All he sensed before him were clouds, white, not quite white, off-white, a slight golden-orange cast. And all turned to gray, and he was drowning. He could not breathe. He struggled desperately to open his clogged throat, to call to Daniil for help. He could make no sound. 12. Bailey was breathing as though he had just breasted the tape at the end of a long race. The room was askew, and there was a hard surface under his left elbow. He realized he was on the floor. Giscard was on his knees beside him, his robot's hand, firm but somewhat cold, closed on Bailey's right fist. The door to the cabin, visible to Bailey just beyond Giscard's shoulder, stood ajar. Bailey knew without asking what had happened. Giscard had seized that helpless human hand and clenched it upon the control edge to end the astro simulation. Otherwise, Daniil was there as well, his face close to Bailey's, with a look on it that might well have been pain. He said, "You said nothing, partner Elijah. Had I been more quickly aware of your discomfort?" Bailey tried to gesture that he understood, that it did not matter. He was still unable to speak. The two robots waited until Bailey made a feeble movement to get up. Arms were under him at once, lifting him. He was placed in a chair and the control was gently taken away from him by Giscard. Giscard said, "We will be landing soon. You will have no further need of the astro simulator, I believe." Daniil added gravely, "It would be best to remove it in any case." Bailey said,
"Wait."
His voice was a hoarse whisper, and he was not sure the word could be made out. He drew a deep breath, cleared his throat feebly, and said again,
"Wait."
And then,
"Giscard."
Giscard turned back.
"Sir?"
Bailey did not speak at once. Now that Giscard knew he was wanted, he would wait a lengthy interval, perhaps indefinitely. Bailey tried to gather his scattered wits. Agoraphobia or not, there still remained his uncertainty about their destination. That had existed first, and it might well have intensified the agoraphobia. He had to find out. Giscard would not lie. A robot could not lie unless very carefully instructed to do so. And why instruct Giscard? It was Daniil who was his companion, who was to be in his company at all times. If there was lying to be done, that would be Daniil's job. Giscard was merely a fetcher and carrier, a guard at the door. Surely there was no need to undergo the task of carefully instructing him in the web of lies.
Giscard,
said Bailey, almost normally now.
Sir?
We are about to land, are we?
In a little less than 2 hours, sir.
That was 2 metric hours, thought Bailey.
More than 2 real hours? Less?
It didn't matter. It would only confuse. Forget it. Bailey said, as sharply as he could manage,
Tell me right now the name of the planet we are about to land on.
A human being, if he had answered at all, would have done so only after a pause, and then with an air of considerable surprise. Giscard answered at once, with a flat and uninflected assertion,
It is Aurora, sir.
How do you know?
It is our destination. Then, too, it could not be Earth, for instance, since Aurora's sun, Tau Ceti, is only 90% the mass of Earth's sun. Tau Ceti is a little cooler, therefore, and its light has a distinct orange tinge to fresh and unaccustomed Earth eyes. You may have already seen the characteristic color of Aurora's sun in the reflection upon the upper surface of the cloud bank. You will certainly see it in the appearance of the landscape, until your eyes grow accustomed to it.
Bailey's eyes left Giscard's impassive face. He had noticed the color difference, Bailey thought, and had attached no importance to it. A bad error.
You may go, Giscard.
Yes, sir.
Bailey turned bitterly to Daniil.
I've made a fool of myself, Daniil.
I gather you wondered if perhaps we were deceiving you and taking you somewhere that was not Aurora. Did you have a reason for suspecting this, partner Elijah?
None. It may have been the result of the uneasiness that arose from subliminal agoraphobia. Staring at seemingly motionless space, I felt no perceptible illness, but it may have lain just under the surface, creating a gathering uneasiness.
The fault was ours, partner Elijah. Knowing of your dislike for open spaces, it was wrong to subject you to astro-simulation, or, having done so, to subject you to no closer supervision.
Bailey shook his head in annoyance.
Don't say that, Daniil. I have supervision enough. The question in my mind is how closely I am to be supervised on Aurora itself.
Daniil said, Partner Elijah, it seems to me it will be difficult to allow you free access to Aurora and Aurorans.
That is just what I must be allowed, nevertheless. If I am to get to the truth of this case of roboticide, I must be free to seek information directly on the site, and from the people involved.
Bailey was by now feeling quite himself, though a bit weary. Embarrassingly enough, the intense experience he had passed through left him with a keen desire for a pipe of tobacco, something he thought he had done away with altogether better than a year before. He could feel the taste and odor of the tobacco smoke making its way through his throat and nose. He would, he knew, have to make do with the memory. On Aurora, he would on no account be allowed to smoke. There was no tobacco on any of the spacer worlds, and if he had had any on him to begin with, it would have been removed and destroyed. Daniil said, Partner Elijah, this must be discussed with Dr. Fastolf once we land. I have no power to make any decisions in this matter.
I'm aware of that, Daniil, but how do I speak to Fastolf? Through the equivalent of an astro-simulator, with controls in my hand?
Not at all, Partner Elijah. You will speak face to face. He plans to meet you at the spaceport.
13.
Bailey listened for the noises of landing. He did not know what they might be, of course. He did not know the mechanism of the ship, how many men and women it carried, what they would have to do in the process of landing, what in the way of noise would be involved. Shouts, rumbles, a dim vibration. He heard nothing. Daniil said, You seem to be under tension, partner Elijah. I would prefer that you did not wait to tell me of any discomfort you might feel. I must help you at the very moment you are, for any reason, unhappy. There was a faint stress on the word must.
Bailey thought absently, The first law drives him. He surely suffered as much in his way as I suffered in mine when I collapsed and he did not foresee it in time.
A forbidden imbalance of positronic potentials may have no meaning to me, but it may produce in him the same discomfort and the same reaction as acute pain would to me. He thought further, how can I tell what exists inside the pseudo-skin and pseudo-consciousness of a robot any more than Daniil can tell what exists inside me? And then, feeling remorse at having thought of Daniil as a robot, Bailey looked into the other's gentle eyes. When did he start thinking of their expression as gentle? And said, I would tell you of any discomfort at once. There is none. I am merely trying to hear any noise that might tell me of the progress of the landing procedure, Partner Daniil.
Thank you, Partner Elijah, said Daniil gravely.
He bowed his head slightly and went on.
There should be no discomfort in the landing. You will feel acceleration, but that will be minimal, for this room will yield, to a certain extent, in the direction of the acceleration. The temperature may go up, but not more than 2 degrees Celsius. As for sonic effects, there may be a low hiss as we pass through the thickening atmosphere. Will any of this disturb you?
Well, it shouldn't. What does disturb me is not being free to participate in the landing. I would like to know about such things. I do not want to be imprisoned and to be kept from the experience.
You have already discovered, Partner Elijah, that the nature of the experience does not suit your temperament.
And how am I to get over that, Daniil? He said strenuously. That is not enough reason to keep me here.
Partner Elijah, I have already explained that you are kept here for your own safety.
Bailey shook his head in clear disgust. I have thought of that, and I say it's nonsense. My chances of straightening out this mess are so small, with all the restrictions being placed on me and with all the difficulty I will have in understanding anything about Aurora, that I don't think anyone in his right mind would bother to take the trouble to try to stop me. And if they did, why bother attacking me personally? Why not sabotage the ship? If we imagine ourselves to be facing no-holds-barred villains, they should find a ship and the people aboard it, and you and Giscard, and myself, of course, to be a small price to pay.
This has, in point of fact, been considered, Partner Elijah. The ship has been carefully studied. Any signs of sabotage would be detected.
Are you sure? 100% certain?
Nothing of this sort can be absolutely certain. Giscard and I were comfortable, however, with the thought that the certainty was quite high, and that we might proceed with minimal expectation of disaster.
And if you were wrong?
Something like a small sign of spasm crossed Daniil's face, as though he were being asked to consider something that interfered with the smooth working of the positronic pathways in his brain. He said, But we have not been wrong.
You cannot say that. We are approaching the landing, and that is sure to be the danger moment. In fact, at this point, there is no need to sabotage the ship. My personal danger is greatest now, right now. I can't hide in this room if I'm to disembark at Aurora. I will have to pass through the ship and be within reach of others. Have you taken precautions to keep the landing safe?
He was being petty, striking out at Daniil needlessly because he was chafing at his long imprisonment and at the indignity of his moment of collapse. But Daniil said calmly, We have, Partner Elijah. And incidentally, we have landed. We are now resting on the surface of Aurora.
For a moment, Bailey was bewildered. He looked around wildly, but of course there was nothing to see but an enclosing room. He had felt and heard nothing of what Daniil had described, none of the acceleration, or heat, or wind whistle. Or had Daniil deliberately brought up the matter of his personal danger once again, in order to make sure he would not think of other unsettling but minor matters? Bailey said, And yet there's still the matter of getting off the ship. How do I do that without being vulnerable to possible enemies?
Daniil walked to one wall and touched a spot upon it. The wall promptly split in two, the two halves moving apart. Bailey found himself looking into a long cylinder, a tunnel. Giscard had entered the room at that moment from the other side and said,
Sir, the three of us will move through the exit tube. Others have it under observation from without. At the other end of the tube, Dr. Fastolf is waiting.
We have taken every precaution, said Daniil.
Bailey muttered,
My apologies, Daniil. Giscard.
He moved into the exit tube somberly. Every effort to assure that precautions had been taken also assured him that those precautions were thought necessary. Bailey liked to think he was no coward, but he was on a strange planet, with no way of telling friend from enemy, with no way of taking comfort in anything familiar, except, of course, Daniil. At crucial moments, he thought with a shiver, he would be without enclosure to warm him and to give him relief.